Our next case for argument is United States against Leonard Allen and Stern. Hanak, we'll wait just a brief time for everyone to quiet down. Ms. Hanak.
Okay. May it please the court, I'm Ellen Hanak, and I represent Walter Stern. Mr. Stiller, who is sitting at the table, represents Norma Leonard Allen. And I wanted to let you know there's been some confusion, but I will be doing the rebuttal.
Okay.
The heart of the case before you now is knowledge. What I'd like to concentrate on today, although I'm prepared to answer any other questions, is the issue of the testimony that Walter was not allowed to give concerning the reasons Norma gave him why he should put the money in his name. Now, as you're all aware, this is a money laundering case, and the key issue at trial was, what did Walter know when he put the money into his own name? The issue here is whether, first of all, it was hearsay when he thought to testify that Norma duped him by telling him that he should do it to protect her from her own impulses. It's a lie because she didn't tell him that she was hiding the assets from bankruptcy, which no one disputes. And it was a lie because she omitted that fact. In any event, the evidence was offered to show what he knew. As was explained below, it was offered for the impact on him. Hearsay, of course, has two parts to it. The first is that a statement's made out of court, and no one disputes that this statement was made out of court. The second one, though, is that it's offered for the truth of the matter asserted. All the parties agree that if Norma told him that it was for this purpose, it was a lie. A lie has no truth. And as this court explained in Norwood, when there's no truth, it can't be for the matter asserted. This simply wasn't hearsay. The more difficult question, of course, is the second question, which is whether this exclusion had a substantial and injurious effect on Walter.
Before you move to the harmless error discussion, if you could address whether the objection that was made was properly fleshed out for the trial judge to know what the argument that this was state of mind evidence and not hearsay.
Okay.
Was that properly fleshed out for the judge?
I believe that it was. Now, I apologize to this court because I didn't give you what I should have given you initially in the first brief. When trial counsel got up and gave his opening statement, trial counsel explained, and this is on page 19 of the record, that Walter was going to testify, and what it said was that he was going to testify that Walter became very concerned, that Norma became very concerned when she got the $95,000, that she did not want it to be in her care. She wanted to make sure that he could, if possible, hold the money for her so that she wouldn't give it to her children, and I'm reading directly from the record now. So she wouldn't have to concern herself that she, being somewhat of a spender, that the money would start to be depleted. Now, immediately after that, there was a sidebar, and the jury was basically told to ignore that unless there was evidence to that effect.
Counsel, I don't understand why this evidence is relevant. Quite apart from the hearsay objection, it looked to me like the only question of knowledge for your client is whether Leonard Allen had filed for bankruptcy. If she had filed for bankruptcy, her reasons for wanting him to hide the money are, I think, completely irrelevant, are they not?
They're irrelevant.
If he's hiding the money for somebody he knows is in bankruptcy, he's guilty.
Yeah, that's the point. It's the knows he's in, she's in bankruptcy, and she... His assertion was throughout the trial that he didn't know she was in bankruptcy. There were three pieces of evidence, basically.
So does he think this evidence will show whether she is in bankruptcy?
No. He thinks it will show whether he knew that she was in bankruptcy. And the reason that that's true is because the government's case is circumstantial about what he knew. We've really got three basic things. The first is the intake form, and which is also in something else. The second is the government's assertion that, of course, he knew because of the relationship. But we all know boyfriends, girlfriends lie to each other all the time, so that's got whatever strength it's got. But the third was the reliance on the idea that his action in putting the money in his name is in itself suspicious. This came up in the government's closing. It came up in the government on rebuttal. This was the best evidence that they had as to his state of mind, because if you believe that the only reason he will put money in his name is to protect it from creditors, it affects not only this, but how you look at that intake form, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Right. It's in the nature. He's got to give an explanation for what he did, because otherwise on its face it looks bad.
On its face it's very suspicious. Why would you take somebody else's money, your boyfriend, girlfriend's money, your girlfriend's money, and put it in your own name? That's an odd action. And the inference, and it's the one that the government specifically told the jury they should make, and there was nothing else in the record to dispute it, was you should infer he was doing it to protect it from creditors. He knew about those creditors. He was doing it to protect it. But once he says, wait a minute, she told me that she wanted it protected from herself, at that point, the statement no longer necessarily corroborates, in a sense, what the government theory of the case is. What it does is that it presents an alternative, reasonable explanation. And the reason that it does so is because putting it in his name now serves some purpose that all of us can understand. If it's in her name, she can get access to the money easily. She doesn't have to stop and think. If it's in his name, she has to go to him first, which by its own, he then presumably says to her, well, why do you want it? Let's talk about this a minute. It gives a second non-suspicious explanation.
This explanation, or this discussion, sort of segues nicely into your harmlessness argument. So perhaps you'd like to move there now in the interest of time.
Well,
based on the rest of the record and the rest of the evidence, you know, once the basis for the evidence is understood, why does it take on such significance that we should find harmful error?
Okay, it takes on such significance mainly because the other big piece of evidence is the data intake form, which is referred to as the intake form, the data form. It's got various names throughout the briefs. What that is it's a form that Norma filled out when she went to see the bankruptcy attorney, Mary Losey. If you look at that form is really rather ambiguous. It's ambiguous in several ways. First of all, the question asked is a little bit odd. It tends to get slapped together in the government's brief as, you know, it's a referral form. It's information about referral. But it really isn't if you look at it.
Well, it says friend / referral. And then she puts Walter Stern down. So is it your argument that she just could have put a friend's name down?
Well,
without a referral.
I think the problem here is, To some extent. I think the problem here is that Walter Stern was an attorney, but he was also her friend. He was her boyfriend at the time. And the slash is sort of an or. So we don't know whether it's a referral, and for a referral you say, well, I need an attorney to do X. Or since Walter was an attorney in the Kenosha area, which is a very small legal area, everybody knows everybody, for all that we know, at some point he talked about Mary Losi, and the honest answer to that question could be, I heard about it through my friend, Walter Stern, who happened to have spoken about Mary Losi. But the difference is...
This sounds like an argument to the jury rather than like an appellate issue.
Well, it is, to except to this extent. The extent to which it is not is that if the jury can take this form two different ways, and we've only got two pieces of evidence...
Well, that's why I say it's an argument to the jury, that you take it in a way favorable to the defendant rather than the way favorable to the prosecutor. Why is this a legal issue?
It's a legal issue because we're talking about harm. And the question is, if we take out the hearsay, which should have been admitted, if the jury had had that, would they have looked at this form differently? And I think the answer is it's very clear that they could have.
So what are we subtracting? I'm confused now. Because I thought you were saying this form shouldn't have come in because even if it was a business record, the information Walter Stern was embedded.
Ms. Hennack, as I understand the time, you asked for 10 minutes and 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your 10 minutes
yes.
has expired.
Okay.
So certainly answer Judge Wood's question, but if you wish to save any time for rebuttal, this is
All right.
time.
The answer to the question is that you look at it differently because if you believe that it's likely that he knew, this confirms it. If you're not sure, it acts as a mirror and you are more likely to see the ambiguities within the form. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Stiller.
May it please the Court, good afternoon. In this consolidated appeal, obviously there's some overlap between the arguments Ms. Hennick is making on Mr. Stern's behalf and those I make on behalf of Ms. Leonard Allen. But I guess I'll take up where she left off to articulate my theory of injury by extension to my client, Ms. Leonard Allen, from the trial court's erroneous limitation, on Mr. Stern's testimony. Mr. Stern controlled my client's concealed asset. In doing so, he laundered money only if he knew it to be a concealed asset. If Stern didn't know that the asset had been concealed by Norma Leonard from the bankruptcy, then we know that Norma Leonard Allen, his former client and girlfriend, didn't tell him that she'd declared for bankruptcy. If my client didn't tell her former lawyer and lover about her bankruptcy, the only reasonable social inference is that she was concealing it from him. And if she was concealing it from her former lawyer and her current lover, then it's nonsensical that she would have concurrently asked him for a referral to a bankruptcy lawyer.
But I guess in the case of Ms. Leonard Allen, I have trouble finding much of importance other than your argument that there was some attorney-client privilege that kept this intake form out. Because otherwise, she testifies to the grand jury that nobody refers her, and there is this friend referral line and Walter Stern's name down. You know, you would have been free to have argued that she just wrote the name randomly. But it's very powerful evidence, and I'm not sure whether Mr. Stern's statements about what caused him to open up the CDs would have really pushed this one way or the other for her.
If I'm reading things right, I'll try to answer and then maybe pivot to the privilege issue. Indeed, the form on its face, without any further explanation, surely proved that Norma told a lie, either to Ms. Losi on the form or to the grand jury under oath. The jury's question, the question for the jury was, when did she lie? the fact that had Walter Stern been allowed to testify, that Norma Leonard lied to her, to him, about the nature and status of this concealed asset, breathes significance into the possibility that her lie, if any, was on the intake form to the bankruptcy lawyer and unsworn, and not the sworn alleged perjury before the grand jury that resulted in the conviction. As to the privilege, I think we're really painting on a largely blank canvas here, because I've tried to get my mind around this circuit's jurisprudence on the issue of the applicability and the inapplicability of the attorney-client privilege. And the only clear rule I can come up with is that if there's one thing and one thing only that this court can't do, it's derogate. And by that I mean, in a case called Matter of Walsh and many others, it's often said that the privilege, when it applies, derogates the search for the truth, and so it should be narrowly construed.
But why isn't this, I mean, I actually have a lot of trouble seeing this as within the scope of the attorney-client privilege. It looks much more like fee arrangements or something like that to me. I don't see anything on this form, maybe except for the line that says financial, which is not what we're worrying about here.
Right.
That in the slightest tips one's hand to the advice she's seeking from the attorney.
As I read things, the privilege applies more to more than simply advice given to the client by the lawyer. Because, of course, advice given by the lawyer to the client is responsive to information
I know
provided.
And I can't see any, I don't see the question posed, I don't see the answer given. There is a set of information that's incidental that is not swept under the privilege. And that I gave you the example of fee arrangements, which are normally not protected. It could have been on a form like this. So I just don't see, thinking of the purpose of the attorney-client privilege, how it's triggered here.
Fee arrangements, which the government relies on and to some extent the trial court relied upon, are generally not themselves communicative. This is different.
What's communicative about this?
The lawyer said, how did you find...
It doesn't even say bankruptcy on the form.
No. The crucial part of the intake form is that the lawyer asked her client-to-be, how did you select this office? The lawyer gave the client
right,
a variety of options.
That's marketing information. It's not...
From the lawyer's perspective.
Legal advice.
From the lawyer's perspective, indeed. But I...
Do you have any case in your favor for the proposition that entries like this are covered by the privilege?
Any no, nor is there any case that's contrary.
Well, the Ninth Circuit has held that it's not covered.
I disagree.
That might be an argument in your favor.
Judge, if you view it in my favor, I'll embrace it for the moment. But certainly the Ninth Circuit, certainly the Ninth Circuit did not hold that. 8 questions were put to a lawyer in advance of a grand jury appearance. 7 of them had to do with payment information and who tendered the lawyer's fees. The 8th one was a simple question. Did anyone refer Ms. Simpson to you? The entirety of the Ninth Circuit's opinion focused on the fee information. The referral question wasn't addressed. And the referral question was different in a meaningful way than the one put to my client by Ms. Losi. In Michelson, the question was merely, was there a referral? In our case, it was a question to the client, not just was there a friend/referral, but who was it? That's communicative, it's revelatory, and it's protective because under Feldberg, the privilege applies when legal advice of any kind is sought from a lawyer acting as a lawyer.
Would you be making this same argument if she had checked the Kenosha News box? I mean, I'm looking at the form, which I appreciate you're putting in the brief.
Judge, I don't mean to be glib. I wouldn't be making this argument because the Kenosha News wouldn't have proven her perjury that got her convicted.
Well, at the time, I think it's important to remember the time when she fills out this form. It's dated July 6, 2005.
Yes.
It's long before Mr. Stern gets involved with putting the $95,000 into CDs.
Yes.
And at the time she writes Walter Stern's name down, whether he knew she'd written it down or not, I have no idea. But it's from that perspective, I don't see what information is revealed about anything she's doing. The lawyer provides four boxes, Yellow Pages, Kenosha News, Friend / Referral, and Other, Please Specify. I don't see what's so revelatory about anything in that.
Judge, I see I'm absolutely out of time. Can I finish my last answer, which is this answer?
You're always free to answer a judge's question. When we're talking, you're talking.
Going back to Feldberg, when legal advice of any kind is sought from a lawyer acting as a lawyer, and we've got that, and the communications relate to that purpose.
And that's what I'm not sure we have.
She was only in Mary Losey's office to secure professional services. Mary Losey's office gave her this clipboard with a form and a series of questions to answer.
All right.
Okay. I'll take that. We have your position. Yeah.
Thank you,
Mr. Stiller.
Thank you.
Mr. Jean Pietro.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gordon Giampietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney here in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States. I also was the prosecutor in the trial below. Without question, the intake form is the key piece of evidence in this case. It supports both convictions.
I think I easily see how it supports Ms. Leonard Allen's conviction, but I think the government, I think it's far weaker evidence vis-a-vis Mr. Stern, since she could have written his name down without his knowledge.
Judge, it's right. I'll clarify my answer in this way. It's clearly the basis for the conviction of Ms. Leonard Allen. It's a piece of the story with respect to Mr. Walter Stern.
And you know what I would like you to talk about with Mr. Stern is on what theory it was impermissible for him to testify about what motivated him to take out the CDs. You start objecting before he, so there's an exchange. Do you recall going to the bank on March 3rd? Question, and how did that come about? Answer, well, about 3 days or so before, and then you look at and object. For all I know, he was about to say, I was standing in the shower thinking about the bank. I mean, I don't know how you can object at that point, and it's well recognized in hearsay that if somebody says something and you're just trying to use that statement as an indication of why you took an action, it doesn't matter if it's true, false, or somewhere in between. It's not for the truth.
And Judge, I, of course, would agree with you. I think in our brief we conceded that the Norwood case probably controls this situation. As to why during the trial I would stand up and object, I think you have to go back in time and put yourself in my shoes, okay? At that point, we don't have a witness statement from Mr. Stern, of course. He hasn't conceded to be interviewed by the FBI. I frankly don't know what's going to come out of his mouth.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you object before he
certainly
says anything.
Not to object.
Yeah, and you're even in your brief where you were trying to say, well, you know, maybe there's this impact on the person or this narrow use, but then there's this other use. I couldn't follow that at all. It seems to me it was very clear that jury could have believed it or not believed it, but he wanted the evidence that the impetus for his going to take out those CDs was the statement that came out of her mouth. And we don't really care if she was telling the truth or lying, because we're talking about his behavior.
Right, Judge, and I think the distinction has to be, though, at this vantage point, sitting here today with the benefit of all of these briefs, and the law has been hashed out, and actually the proffer is now made in the appellate brief as to what he was going to testify to, I would agree with you completely. That was not a proper objection on my part. And had
so you'll concede that that was error and we'll just move to harmless error?
I'm prepared to do that, Judge, because I do think under Norwood, my argument is at the district court, if I had known what he was going to say and it was offered for that purpose, I would not have objected. It's clearly an appropriate use of Norwood.
But the judge seems to get terribly confused. I'm reading through these transcripts. The judge doesn't seem to understand what defense counsel means when he's trying to say, this is really just for the impact on him. It's, you know, and the judge just says, no, it's hearsay.
Well, and I think, Judge, that goes back to, that's a good segue into the Fountain decision that Mr. Stern cited in his reply brief. And that is, the reason the judge is in that situation is because, unlike in Fountain, there was no motion in limine filed that could alert the court both to the proffered evidence and also the basis for admitting.
Defendants don't have to file motions alerting the court to their evidence. It's their right to produce evidence by surprise.
Understood, Your Honor.
It sounds like you're saying, I was entitled to object to this because I was going to be surprised, and therefore it was objectionable, and therefore I was entitled to mislead the court, and now I'm going to argue harmless error.
This is
not a happy change.
Yeah, no, I don't agree, Judge. I believe that, again, under Rule 103, if it's dealing with the exclusion of evidence, the defender, the proponent of that evidence has to make an offer for the court.
No, not a defendant doesn't have to go in pretrial.
If
they do, then there are certain consequences.
If evidence is excluded, you have to make an offer of proof, but that's not to say that you have to make your offer of proof before the trial starts or to let the assistant U.S. attorney know what's coming.
I agree with that, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is if you're reviewing this issue for abuse of discretion, you're trying to determine whether the trial court judge here abused his discretion. And what I'm saying, it's very hard on this record to second-guess a judge.
Well, it's not that hard if the judge completely misunderstands the hearsay rule. I mean, there are legal dimensions to this as well as discretionary dimensions.
But, Judge, what I would respectfully say, though, is by the failure to make the offer of proof at the time that I made my hearsay objection, the defendant makes it incredibly hard for a district judge to get this right. And so it's all well and good to say at this stage, where we have the benefit of the briefs, at the discussion of Norwood, and we have the benefit of what he would have said, to say the judge made an error. No one's going to argue that that's not the case with the benefit of hindsight.
Well, but here we have more of the court lets a little bit in. Question, what was the plan? Answer, I was going to open a CD in my name with Norma as payable on death, and I was going to care for the money. You object again to strike as hearsay. Court says, no, I will allow that answer. And then there's a question, and you having control of it was to serve what purpose? You object, calls for hearsay answer, and the court sustains the objection. By this time, I think the court has been alerted as to what is going in. These objections keep coming, and it does make a big difference to the money laundering conviction whether the jury hears just one side, hears this $95,000 that should have been in the bankruptcy and wasn't, or whether the jury hears two sides, you know, she's a spendthrift versus the bankruptcy, and the jury chooses.
And Judge, I think all of that is valid and is why I'm conceding that it was error to exclude this testimony. What I want to get to, though, is why it was harmless. And I think the reason it's harmless is something that I think Judge Easterbrook touched on earlier in his questions, and that's this. The real key question in this case was Mr. Stern's knowledge of the bankruptcy. And that...
Yeah, that I understand. That's why I asked that question. But I thought Ms. Hennack had an answer to it, so you might want to deal with her answer, which is that you were arguing an inference from the fact that there was no other reason for him to put the money in his own name other than to hide it from the creditors in bankruptcy. And what Ms. Hennack said is, well, but we had another reason, and it can't be harmless to keep the other reason out and then argue that this is a basis for conviction.
And I agree, Judge, but what this court's cases say is there's only error here, there's only not harmless error, when the defendant's primary, or when the evidence excluded was the defendant's primary or only defense. And what I'm pointing to, and we did this in our brief, there were other parts of this transcript where Mr. Stern was able to testify to the following, why he did this. Norma wanted me to take care of her money. That was one. Two, I was going to care for that money and protect the money. The only aspect of this story that was excluded was because she was a spendthrift.
That's kind of key, though. I mean, that's the why question. It's the kind of thing that lay jurors, if that gap isn't filled, we'll fill it with your theory of the case.
To a certain extent, yes, Judge. And that's why I say if I had to do this over again, I would have let this in and argued it. And here's what the response would be to the jury, right? It's well and good to say that I want someone to take care of my money, and that's why he's taking hold of it. There's really no good explanation for why it's in his name.
Well, there's every reason why it's in his name if you believe her spendthrift theory, because if it's in her name, it's pointless. And it's a lot of money. I mean, at least jurors are going to think $95,000 is a lot of money. And so most of us don't just, you know, hand it over to the person we're sitting next to.
Right. And I agree, Judge, but the difficulty is, and I would have been able to argue this in closing because this evidence would have been in, is I would have said, well, wait a second. He says that he had to have it in his name because she told him she was a spendthrift. The problem with that is,
and why? They're living together, right?
Yes.
I mean, they're in a cohabitation relationship, so the argument you would have been confronting on the other side is that people who are living cooperatively, sharing living expenses, sometimes do things like this.
But, Judge, I don't think so. I think what we argued in closing, trial counsel for the defense argued, everybody does this. You go to a stockbroker to have them take care of your money for you. You go to a friend to have them take care of your money for you. In rebuttal, what I pointed out to the jury was, no, you don't put your money in your stockbroker's name, and no, you don't put your money in your friend's name. There's really no reason. Again, I feel like we're arguing to the jury here.
But lots of people might, a man who's going to be out of the country for a year might put money in his wife's name so that she will have an easier time dealing with it.
And actually, if you made that argument to the jury about you don't put money in your stockbroker's name, that's completely wrong. Many people have their holdings in their stockbroker's name. It's called holding in street name. It's an important part of certain investment strategies.
Well, again, I would say, Judge, in the circumstances of this case, Mr. Stern is not a stockbroker. He happens to be...
Well, it's true. You might have been making an argument that would be more persuasive to a juror that was ignorant about how stocks are held than a jury that was knowledgeable, but it's not clear how an argument to a jury that didn't know how stocks are held will show this is all harmless.
Again, Judge, the other thing I want to get to is, again, we're sitting here at the appellate level, not with the benefit of, like, as the jury did, of eyeballing Mr. Stern as he testifies. And this is an important point, right? Because he takes the stand and tells this jury, I had no idea she was in bankruptcy. He's confronted, and that's why I started out my argument with, everything that Mr. Stern argues on appeal really does hinge on the proper admissibility of the intake form. Because when that's in evidence, she's convicted of perjury, as she was, and his protestations in front of the jury that he was ignorant of the bankruptcy is, in the jury's mind, not believable. And this is why I say that secondary argument about...
And your argument for how the name comes in, obviously you're arguing that the form comes in as a business record, and you're arguing there's nothing privileged about this form, so we're on top of everybody's argument on both sides. But how does the second layer of hearsay come in? You mentioned in your brief quite prominently the residual exception, but it's been my observation that the Supreme Court has been very disapproving of the use of the residual exception of late.
It's been disapproving of the use of the non-residual exception.
That's true. So I'm very wary of going in that direction.
Judge, obviously the first issue of admissibility as to Leonard Allen's clearly comes in as a statement of a party opponent. So it comes into evidence as to her, no question. Then we have the two alternative bases with respect to Mr. Stern, a co-conspirator statement and then also the residual clause. With respect to the residual clause, I recognize, at some point, that's the catch-all. It's sort of the last...
Right. And here's my issue with the co-conspirator exception. There's never a Santiago proffer in this case. There's never anything that would explain, what's the scope of the conspiracy, why is this statement something that's being done in furtherance of the conspiracy. It's 3 months before she ever even files her schedules with the bankruptcy court. So for all I know, at that time, she was planning on coming clean with it. I have no idea. But I didn't see a foundation for the co-conspirator exception.
Right.
Had that foundation been there, then that would be a very different matter.
The first time that comes into the record, Your Honor, is when I filed a motion in limine 2 weeks before trial suggesting as the basis for admission the co-conspirator statement. And I suggested to the court this notion that she put his name down with a theory that Walter Stern, being a prominent lawyer in the community, would somehow cause Attorney Losi to give him preferential treatment or take his case. Now,
that seems so absurd when she's willing to take somebody from the Kenosha News.
Judge, I don't disagree with you, and I'm not going to hang my hat on the co-conspirator exception.
But if you don't have the co-conspirator and we don't have residual, what is it that lets the use of his name by her come in against him?
Candidly, nothing. I mean, those are the two bases upon which they're admitted against Walter Stern. But back to the...
And so you just said that this is a crucial form in the case for Walter Stern.
Absolutely, Judge. I concede that. If the form doesn't come into evidence, there are serious problems with both of these convictions. But back to the co-conspirator issue.
Well, bigger problems with his than... I mean, I know she was moving to sever, but we do have two separate cases before us.
Yes, but if I don't have the intake form with respect to her, I don't have evidence of her perjury in the grand jury. So, but to go.
I'm confused now. So you think that because the intake form, let's say, might not be admissible vis-a-vis her, then it automatically is not admissible vis-a-vis
no,
him
no,
either?
I misspoke. It comes in against her as a statement of a party opponent.
Right. So
yes.
If you can address the privilege, it comes in against her, but it might not come in against him.
Yes. But again, I recognize what the court is saying about, you know, the Supreme Court's disapproval of the residual clause.
I don't like it.
But, you know, it is what it is. And if you go through, it is.
And what are the guarantees of trustworthiness? That's pretty hard to.
Well, I would say, Judge, here I can't think of a better document in terms of circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. This is a marketing document prepared by a law firm.
But
the client who comes in.
But it's the content of the word Walter Stern that you're trying to show has some guarantees of trustworthiness, and no one monitors this. I mean, you know, she could have put Mickey Mouse down on there. She could have put your name down in there.
I think you have to look at the circumstances at the time and the circumstances under which the statement was given. It's not a statement given to a law enforcement officer. It's not a statement given after the individual has thought about whether it matters what they put down on the form. This is a question, who referred you? She's certainly in a position to know. She has absolutely no reason to mislead Attorney Losi as to who referred her.
I don't know that Ms. Leonard Allen has made me want to believe that, but.
Well, Judge, I respectfully, again, recognizing the residual clause is sort of the very bottom rung of the ladder, it is what it is. And if you go through the checklist of the residual clause, I can't think of a document that more clearly fits within it. So thank you very much for your time, and we ask that you affirm on both bases.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Hennig?
No, we raised
the. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Our final.